world of technology and our, let's say, human society and agenda is basically in this cocoon state, and we have to push it. Now is the time to push it towards the butterfly. So we have to set up the mission. We have to bring in this narrative that change is possible, but you have to be part of the change. This is the only thing we have.
Welcome to Let's Talk Change. Human history is a long series of adaptations to disruptive change. The impact of innovation and scalability of today's technologies is powerful. They either deteriorate or improve living conditions on Earth. In this podcast series, we sit down with decision makers, innovators, experts, and visionaries to discuss how technologies, business innovations, policies, and improved communication can drive the change we need to amplify sustainable behavior in business and politics for the benefit of the people and the planet.
My name is Doreen, and I have a special guest today who is a futurist. But what does a futurist to do with climate change? And what does climate change has to do with moonshot thinking? And how can every one of us be a Neil Armstrong? This and much more on the new Let's Talk Change podcast with Harald Neidhardt from Future.io. Hi, Harald. Thanks for being on the show. Let's Talk Change. I'm very happy to have you. You are actually a futurist and have been dealing with a lot of innovation in your life. And today you are here to talk about climate change, and not just about climate change, but how we can tackle the problem with moonshot thinking. So welcome. And first of all, tell me a little bit about yourself and your company and what you do.
Thanks, Doreen, for the invite. This is a pleasure to be on your show. Yeah, a little bit about myself. I'm the CEO and curator of Future.io. And Future.io is an institute. We call ourselves the European Institute of Exponential Technologies and Desirable Futures. And that's obviously a long name, but what it encompasses is, I think, first of all, we have a European point of view. We're starting to get a more global reach, but being European is, first of all, close to my heart. It's a fantastic creative region. And there is something that over the last decades, I spent years in the US and with Silicon Valley technologies. And I feel that, first of all, the longing for insights from America is no longer just on the top priority list. I think we have so much innovation and creative people in Europe that we have to bring closer together. And if we look at Europe, also at the technology part, that is that we look at exponential technologies and we want that people make informed decisions. So you have to understand AI and robotics, and you can make a decision to say, well, that might not be appropriate for me to invest in the next 1 or 2 years. Great. But please don't say in 2 years, oh, nobody told me, I haven't known, and so on. So inherently is in there my personal vendetta with the term digital transformation, because I'm in digital since, 3 decades probably now. And we knew a lot of things and a lot of innovation were on the horizon. A lot of people use it already. But if people still talk about digital transformation now, I think it's the clocked up investment, which they didn't take on action 5 years ago, or maybe even 10 years ago. And that leads me to this decade of action we are all in, but also our term desirable future. So the idea is that we have to not only think that the future will happen because somebody is in charge, whether it's politicians or in some sense Bill Gates. No, it's all of us. So it's not like this one big power who makes all the framework or who is inspiring and inventive. It is individuals. It starts with a young person who was in South Africa, now is in Silicon Valley and is called Elon Musk. But there is 1,000 people who are as creative. I think a very beautiful example for this is BioNTech and the founding pair. But this is a long intro, so I just stop here now and we go with the flow. But I want to go back to this as an example, because it's about also understanding story and a narrative that we need, I think, in these times.
You choose a day to launch this campaign, which is the Moonshot Day, or that is part of sort of this trigger that initiated this climate activity. What has it got to do with the moon and the moon landing?
I'm fascinated with space and the technology around it. But I also felt that when the moon landing was on actually my mom's birthday in 1969. I saw it on TV. I was pretty small, but still, and you felt something was happening. And in a way, I think I carry this kind of optimism, because if you can achieve this, going to the moon and setting the goal to do the hard things, and that's why the JFK moonshot speech, which we celebrate on the 25th of May, as you mentioned, as something where 60 years ago, a politician or inspiring person of his time basically set a goal. And he said, let's go to the moon before the decade is out. And he did not really say how exactly and so on. He was more or less asking Congress for money so that NASA can figure it out. And at that time, they did not have invented Teflon or Velcro or all the tools you need. And it was also a time of crisis. And so at 61, he inspired the nation to basically say, okay, let's build an industry. Let's tackle this challenge and actually achieve it before the decade is out. And I feel that this kind of moonshot thinking has been our mantra for the last 3 years since we started Future.io. Say we need to think bigger. And this is a futuristic point of view, but also optimistic. And if most people think about the future, they might think about the next 18 months, like, oh, the lease of the car is up and maybe there's vacation, hopefully next year. But after that, it's like, oh, and sometimes I'm old and I'm in retirement. But the part in between and the feeling for time, whether it's, you know, everything between 18 years or the next decade, it's so uncertain that people don't really grasp it. But here we have an example that if you think big, try to set up something which might be happening in the next 8 to 9 years, but then also use this kind of focus to bring other people together as a platform, as multiple industries, and cross-pollinate, learn from other people. For some people, it's frightening because you have no certainty. Yeah, exactly where innovative, creative people are coming in. And over the last 3 years at Future.io, we have established corporate events, executive programs where we worked with chief digital officer, chief innovation officer, and so on. And that was sort of very close invite-only happenings, including meeting in Davos. But now we're opening this up as a platform and use the date and this anniversary to say, I think right now we need 1,000 Kennedys. So that is what's inspiring me. It starts with a person. It can start with 10 people, you know, the misfits, Steve Jobs, put them out there. But if we have 1,000 Kennedys who support what Greta and Louisa and the young people are doing on the street, but bring them into the corporate environment, that's the lens we're using and say, okay, this thing is so big, the challenge is big, the timing is somehow hard to grasp for people, but if we bring it a little bit closer to the environment and your workday, I think we can try to achieve something.
Now, the whole time you were talking about the moon, I couldn't stop thinking about Elon Musk and the Mars.
Yeah.
And now we already think about going to Mars. Oh, he actually has plans to go to Mars and settle people there. But shouldn't we concentrate really on trying to save Earth and instead of thinking about Mars and other planets?
Totally. We know that, you know, there's Earth shot, so we don't need a moon shot to go to the moon. What is the interesting part, I think, is sort of, you know, the first time when they went to the moon and circle around the astronauts, one of the first pictures was taken, which is sort of Earth's rise, where you see from the foreground of the moon a little bit, but you see Earth and you see this blue marble and you see this, you know, the beauty, and the astronauts describe this as the overview effect, and you know, only around 500 people have seen it from space. And you see that, well, this is the only thing we have. This is a small blue planet. Everything we know, everything which was invented from humans, is there, except for the couple of metal things which are maybe still on the moon. There's a beautiful talk from Alexander Gerst, the astronaut, where he talks about a memo to his grandchildren, which are unborn, that here more or less excuses ourselves, the human race, that we are like not really taking care of it. And so space or space technology is, for me, mostly a metaphor. We have to zoom out, look back at what we have. Sometimes you live in, I don't know, a city for 10 years, you go 1 year abroad, you come back, ah, now you appreciate what you had. You know, the baguette is better in Paris or the coffee is better in Berlin. So sometimes you need to get out of it. And that is, for me, this kind of mindset of moonshot thinking. We say, okay, zoom out, now focus on what we have. And yes, you know, some part of the technology that maybe Elon Musk is using to go to Mars ultimately is helping us with maybe install cameras so that you have data analytics for agriculture that we say, hey, actually, you know, it's going to rain tomorrow, so bring out your seed. So information, and some of that information technology basically is helping us. But the focus is definitely not out in space. The focus is on planet Earth.
Do you think the initial space race that we had, you know, since you've been dealing a lot with space and planets. Do you think it was misguided or fate?
I think it was needed. It was something like humans want to expand. They want to go faster, you know, and whatever. So you have to explore and then come back. You know, we did this with sailing ships, we as human race, and then we took to the air and then we took to space. So that's sort of, okay, you want to go to where the edge and find the boundaries and step over it a little bit. Then you learn, okay, what's the edge? That's sort of a human urge. And space was part of that. Now there was space, then there was a US-Russian, you know, politics and war games going on. Basically, there was a sign of their times. Now, the part of the secondary industries, like, as I said, Velcro or Teflon or something like that, that is the interesting part where we look at different industries, mobility or so, where is now change happening? And it might not always be the first step. Like electric cars is could be a great first step because at least it is a step. But finally, green hydrogen in a decade or so, that will be much more ultimately because you have to watch out similarly with maybe e-mobility that, well, what are we doing with the lithium and is the working conditions of this good? You can never really have sort of a super perfect product at the first shot, but at least at one point you cannot only say, oh yeah, no, we only wait until it's perfect, like typical German. So basically when Elon restarted the electric car industry with Tesla, he was smiled at, he will never do it and so on. But now the Volkswagens of the world are catching up and sometimes you need to go out there, let's say mentally or physically in space and then come back and say, okay, what does actually mean if you build electric cars for 10 million people rather than only the richest 250 or something?
What do you envision? You're a trend specialist and innovation specialist. You've been dealing with new innovations and stuff for many years. So what do you envision the next 10 years will be like in terms of technology and innovation? Do you think we'll be still flying around the world? Do you think like electric airplanes are taking over? What is sort of your take on that?
I think that the good thing is it's so unpredictable that I'm so curious to, you know, to play a role in it and to witness this and to bring in a community who is driving this and learn from each other. So first of all, I think technology, as we see, especially now in these COVID times, space plays a massive role in changing our behavior, changing how do we order food or things we buy. And I think some of this lens or extreme situation in COVID and working from home also will, you know, keep a habit. You know, if you do a diet and you only do it for 10 days, that's yo-yo. But if you do it extending over a month, then all of a sudden there's habit change and then like, oh, okay, I like this now. And then it's easier for you to stay with it. So I think this is what we are in. Rather that we are in this digital transformation, I think we're actually going into a metamorphosis. So it's not, as you say, an era of change, is a change of eras. So we're actually into something new. And if you use the butterfly, there's a caterpillar and then you have a cocoon. We are literally in the cocoon right now. We have been there for 13 months. Luckily, we will, you know, probably go back to other life we know, but there's also the big unknown. And somewhere you see that's written, nothing in the caterpillar actually says that this is going to be a butterfly. But we are in this gooey state right now. We have some, you know, genes or some of us and some of our habits is still in the old part. Some is still in the new one. And right now it's a very, very fragile state because we have to give it that other week to stay in the cocoon so that the butterfly come out. So some of the time you need that ripening, you need the distortion, you need some of the chaos, let's say, in order to then go through it and say, okay, there has to be something better out there. And in the butterfly, well, there's a butterfly and that's beautiful. So that's also why I think storytelling and narrative and so on is important so that we not only have the technology drive this, because this is a part of understanding exponential technologies. Now with the flattening the COVID curve, people understand, even Merkel tells me about exponential change. So I probably know now what it is. Now, there has been so many different exponential changes coming. The technology part is almost the easiest what we understand. Every 2 years there's a new phone. It's probably a little bit faster than the other one. Or the extreme is a hard disk and say, oh, you want to buy a hard disk just around the holiday time. And it's $69 for 1 terabyte. But 2 weeks later, it's 2 terabytes for the same price. It's always going, going, going. We understand the technology pattern. And you feel sometimes like there's this ICE train coming towards you. Fast, fast, fast. Now, if you take a step back, there's actually more trains coming towards you exponentially, biotech, nanotech, AI, robotics. So these are stuff, things which are sort of in the peripheries. And we start talk about AI and artificial intelligence, obviously, and robotics in terms of maybe they take my job away. But some of these technologies now need to have some guidance. We talk about ethics, but also, well, should we just use the tech to go to the moon? No, we need the technology in order to solve the climate crisis and in order to solve the sustainability goals of the UN. And that is what I think is so fascinating, that technology and understanding technology is great, but we are no longer just doing it to push forward and make the, you know, next faster hard disk. We need the technology and the understanding of what's possible with this exponential change for solving these sustainability goals. And maybe this is where, for example, I can mention the BioNTech again, because it's a perfect example of, first of all, you have a great couple who are passionate and do this since years. Now, the ground research for messenger RNA, which is the basis of their vaccination, is 30 years old. And there was a female engineer and she was pushing it. And 30 years ago, nobody believed in it. And so exponential technology is, let's say, from the last 30 years, 28 years, more or less, nobody knew about it. And nobody cared and was really tough. But then you find followers or other engineers like the BioNTech founders who say, oh, wow, there was ground research. Now we push it to the limits. And then you get investors and so on. It takes a long time. But it took 30 years to have more or less the ability to have a 1-year race to get the vaccine, which was unheard of. So it's sort of like popcorn. You put it in your pen and nothing happens for, I don't know, 10 minutes. You always want to throw it away because maybe this is bad. And all of a sudden, one thing pops. And then within the next minute, the whole pan goes off. And this is sort of the moment we're in right now. And what we have to realize, I think, is that technology so far has been untamed. We have gone from 1G to 2G to 4G to 5G, or we went from Google this to Google that and Apple and so on. Now we have to say, okay, great. We know now what you can do. And that's sort of the, let's say, startups and venture capital. The big thing people want to do is, oh, understand AI. And then you're a startup person. And then you create a company who has 5-minute faster pizza delivery. And I said, that's nice, but that is 2015. We have to stop this. We have now to apply these geniuses and their talent towards the bigger picture, and that's climate change and the sustainability goals.
I'd like to get your perspective on this because, you know, unlike many others we're interviewing for this podcast who come from the side of the politics or who have researchers, scientists, you know, when we talk about technology, especially when it comes to climate change, we do have the solutions, right? We could have had electric cars on the road years ago. We could have had massive amounts of solar. It's not like solar is new, except what we did is we pushed solar into areas where they use forced labor to produce this because it's cheap. So margins are higher, so we can build it cheaper and cheaper. So what I'm trying to say is that it's not a case of technology, I think. So from your perspective, why haven't we established all these super technology, so I actually moved them forward, like electric mobility, years ago? It's not like we couldn't have. From a technology innovation point of view, what is your take on that? Why didn't we do it? Is it really as simple as profit driven by the big corporations or by the fossil industry? Or is there something else that we're missing here?
I think it has been too easy to avoid it. I mean, we just saw recently in Germany that the law of climate change, which everybody was proud of, was actually sent back and said, no, you have to really do it harder, not just like do what's possible. You have to push for the impossible or push for the real one. And so here in the car industry, I think as well, they saw Tesla, they saw what he's doing, they saw even the price of his stock rise, but they were still making fun. And I have a friend who works as one of these car companies, and still 2-3 years ago, he was making fun and said, yeah, the millimeters between when you open the door, there's a German word for it, Spaltmaß. Nobody knows it except for 100 miles around your car factory place. But then Germany, we were so proud of it. We were amazing in bending metal. We were amazing in finding the last, you know, engine things and so on. And there was a network of suppliers and family businesses and hidden champions. Amazing. Now, the market was going well. And if the only focus was on the money and the stakeholders and the shareholders, then there was no new money, either from venture capitalists and or really research grants to say, okay, why don't you push it into the green zone? Again, this is sort of the popcorn effect right now. 2021, for example, marks the new budget for the European Commission for Horizon Europe. And Professor Mariana Mazzucato of University College in London, she has a book about, you know, the mission economy. So she brings this also the JFK moment and his thinking about public innovation and funding plus private execution. So the bonding of the two mechanisms is seen in a new way. And one of the challenge basically, which is, I think, supported with 7 billion euros, is can we achieve to get 100 climate cities by 2030? And for that, 100 cities, 7 billion is earmarked for it. And it's similar to JFK. And that's why I find it so fascinating. They are not funding AI for cities or quantum for cities or something else. They just say, okay, this is a thing. You as a city, we need you to measure and bring this into climate change. And they might actually even fund if one city says, yeah, we need a lot of green color to protect the streets for bicycles, because maybe the behavior change in going from cars to bicycle is better than having, you know, self-driving cars. So technology is as a crossroads, because I think it's no longer a simple straight line that of course we will have self-driving cars. I think that is still pretty much up to debate if this is a phenomenon which you need maybe on the autobahn because it's a boring thing, or somewhere in cities because that's the only way how to solve with congestions, but it will not be one solution for everything. I always say something like, easy is over. It's complicated. You see from my answers, I cannot make an answer which is only three sentences, because the world of technology and our, let's say, human society and agenda is basically in this cocoon state, and we have to push it. Now is the time to push it towards the butterfly. So we have to set up the mission. We have to bring in this narrative that change is possible, but you have to be part of the change. And I look at it also, especially on the, let's say, as a corporate lens, but that is maybe the next chapter here, because I feel that you have a lot of people also from the policy point of view, or the discussion is putting an onus only on me as a person and say, yeah, you private person, you should not fly anymore and maybe eat less meat, be veggie, and then the world is great. No, we need that the cement is no longer burning fossil fuels and that is getting green. And we need also to know that a lot of industries have to change. They have to work on their specific goals. And we as a person in our corporate life. So we're doing 8 hours at home and sleep. We're 8 hours at corporate. During that time, we have to make bolder moves and decisions. Sometimes somebody has maybe only the power to change from white copy paper to recycling paper. But that, if you trigger it up to the corporate level and the chief strategy officers and the CEOs, their buying power, the attention they give, or the structure and the innovation they are focusing on, that's what we need right now. Because we have sort of the activist and the policy life that's greater, and where policy is looking backwards, more or less. You have your private life, but I feel we're missing this one part of the triangle, and that's a sort of the where the corporations come in. We know there's a pressure from BlackRock and that movement. A lot of things are happening at the same time, and I'm very positive that now is a time to push harder and say, okay, it's obvious, let's do it. Take a first step.
Absolutely right. And I think a lot of people are now moving in the direction you just said. We have all the VCs now kind of implementing sustainable clauses when they invest and stuff. So you have corporations trying to lower their CO2 emissions. I mean, the whole debate on CO2 offsets and storage is another one we won't touch that today. But the main question, the elephant in the room, yeah, let's call it that one, is the big how. And this is where I feel like society is a bit divided. There's one group says we need policies, yeah, because without policies, without a CO2 price, corporations just continue the way they operate and without certain laws, and that the single person can't really do much. Because if you live in a rental home, how are you gonna push for it being energy efficient or low carbon? We can probably do that if you own a house, but if you live in cities, you have a rental apartment. Same thing with cars. Yes, many people want an electric car, but there's no charging infrastructure, kind of the egg and hen problem. Then how are they gonna solve the problem? So the big elephant in the room is this how. How do we get there that everything basically plays together? We have certain policies, we have corporations really becoming more sustainable, and then the individual coming in as well. So what do you think is needed in order for everything to come together and everything working together. Because right now, from what I see is, you know, there are certain countries, certain policies, US, certainly Europe, we do have massive climate goals. We have certain corporations complying to things also because they don't want to lose their customers. But then this whole society part is kind of missing. How do we integrate this?
For me, it's sort of sustainable innovation. And I think innovation for a lot of people always meant, there's the techies, they are innovative and there's a chief innovation officer or something. But not a lot of people reflect that you can innovate, meaning you can make some new decisions, you can dare a little bit, you can do something new which was not planned and just try it, so to say, and that on all levels. So we were lucky, we were invited 2 years ago to help the UN Climate Change Secretariat, and they invited us to come to South Korea, and there was a global adaptation week. And for a whole week, we facilitated workshops about and using moonshot thinking as a method. And so just when we had the discussion before, they said, climate. I mean, look, we know since 30 plus years what's happening. We know of the data. All the books are written, but nothing changed from the behavior point of view. And also there I said, maybe we should try something new, a new workshop method, or just kind of think about the future in a different way. And I'm very impressed by some of the people there, like Dr. Youssef Nassef. He's a director for adaptation. And he, for example, says, you know, the SDGs are more or less trying to solve the problems of 2015 by the year 2030. But maybe we should also look at the potential problems of 2030 and either avoid them and or put them into the discussion right now so that there's policy also moving forward or looking forward. Because that is where policy and UN obviously is a global government trust or organization is a better word. But basically for me, policy is you look at the last 3 years or five, if there's a pattern, and then you set a rule that is then probably happening in the next 3 or 4 years. And the whole process is too long and it's just looking backwards. And I think we need to say, hey, what we learned in the car industry in the last, 10 years, let's apply it for how people move in a city, and then have 10 other industries maybe have a better framework and say, okay, now I can innovate, but here's what we have to look at. And maybe an example could be this GDPR, European privacy law. And all of a sudden, you know, only in Europe it was started, but now if you want to make business, which the world wants to do business with Europe, you have to apply these rules. And that's why I also think that Europe and the European Commission and so on, if we try to set and be the example for climate and other sustainability goals, we can, I think, set examples. You can bring in new ideas, you can innovate, and you can dare a little bit more so that we have a grasp on the future, not just like say in 5 years, now we looked at 20 to 25 and saw what was wrong, and then, you know, make the policy maybe for the next year. So I think, again, we have to owe it also to our kids. I have two daughters I'm proud of, and we have to help them that this decade of action leads to the change we need until 2021. And 2021, for most people, speaking about futurism, that sounds so Star Trek. 2100, that like, if we don't do anything and we have 4 degrees in 2100, I have to admit, a couple of years ago, I was still thinking, that's probably the grandkids of my kids. You have no relationship to that. But actually, the kids who are alive today, they will be alive in 2100. So that's not Star Trek. That's not flying cars or, you know, warp speed. This is our kids, and this is the generation now. It will be very direct, and that also, for me, was sort of the epiphany. And say, it's me also. We have to change, and I can try to bring in, and with the faculty and the network of Future OSA, all right, let's bring in cross-pollination experts for different industries, and then just like see if we can use innovation to solve and work in this momentum, and then see if we can bring in some solutions which then have more profound impact.
Let's quickly go back to the moonshot day. How can I moonshot? How can I get onto this moonshot thinking as a normal person?
Yeah, well, I think that's what we try to do. So how can we use this abstract way and say, can you make a first step, almost like the first step on the moon from Armstrong? On the platform before this decade is out, we will allow you to kind of, you know, be involved, learn people, learn about the backgrounds, because that's our background, that we want to bring learning and the knowledge about climate change change and innovation and what startups are doing and so on. So you can learn about that, but also you can give your own pledge that you say, hey, before this decade is out, I will do this and this. And you will see how I think it's beautiful done. And the whole idea for us is to say, okay, one first step from you will inspire 10 others. And maybe similarly to the story, which was when JFK visited Houston, the Mission Control Center, once during this moon endeavor, he was talking to a person in cleaning and he asked him, and what are you doing here? And the answer was, Mr. President, I bring a man to the moon. So I help. Even if I'm just a cleaning person, even if I feel I might be, oh, I'm just sitting here at my desk. No, we are all, and you are part of it, and you can do your share. I think it's, again, if we build this narrative, and that's what we want to do. It's an invitation as an open platform. We have friends and partners and people say, hey, can I do this in my industry or in my country? That's what we want, that we look at people, say, oh, that step inspired me to do the second step. And can we do this together? Perfectly. Yes, it's an open invitation. And, you know, you can maybe plant a tree. Just do one first step, because even if you feel you just plant one tree, somehow your mind will change and then say, okay, now I do. Maybe you switch your job and start a startup and bring your talent in there. But the basic for us is community, cross-pollinating, you know, learn from each other, hopefully help other initiatives. And if we can be a small part in it and kind of open up this platform for other new ideas, then that is our first step. We are in education and trying to bring the knowledge and the community around innovation together. And that's our mission here, to see, can we help spread this in a bigger way?
Last question is, what do you think will be a tangible impact before the decade is running out when it comes to climate change or to the future of our planet, actually?
Obviously, it's a big job for all of us. And if it starts on one end, as I said, with planting trees, and on the other end, it's building a global classroom. I mean, that's my dream, that we can bring some of the knowledge from Europe to the Southern Hemisphere, from Asia to Africa, and from Chile to Norway, maybe. I think that's also a good example for Europe, that, you know, who really goes from Berlin to, I don't know, Madrid to go to learn something, or from Norway to Amsterdam. In our innovation space and technology driven, where before we were meeting maybe in conferences, we were much rather go to the US and meet at a conference in Austin rather than meet somewhere and collaborate. So I think it's a huge chance if we can bring in collaborations between people, that they develop new products, or maybe there's an investor who says, wow, this startup which was pitched here, or which was told the story, now we have a way to help invest and people can collaborate on hackathons or something. All these ideas, I think the more we bring the narrative around that you can do your first step, then we will make a huge impact, I think.
So kind of the Obama, we can do it, with the JFK before the decade is out, is kind of the best combination for a narrative, right?
Yeah, I think so. Like, your first step, a small step for you, Armstrong, is a giant step for mankind if we do it together. So we have to be open. We have to look at new ideas. We have to build our minds. And we have to start thinking that we want to be a butterfly, that if you want something, you can vote, you can change your behavior, and you can educate yourself. And that way will inspire others. With your story, you will inspire others. And that's, I think, our human capacity. We want stories. We want to share our own, learn from others. And I think that's the time now. We need this narrative towards a greener tomorrow and a better future, a desirable future, not just a future. No, we have to push for the better one. If we can do a part in this, then I think our first step will hopefully be remembered as something that was worthwhile.
Thanks so much, Harald, for your time. That was a great insight into the Moonshot landing. And I'm looking forward to the campaign and actually to some great ideas that are coming out of your platform and network.
Thank you so much.
Thanks again for tuning in. We hope you'll join us next time on Let's Talk Change. We are proud to be powered by DWR Eco, an international cleantech consultancy for business strategies, communications, and public affairs.